Seeking mental health care can be overwhelming and even scary, but it doesn't have to be. I'm Dr. Josephine McNary, and I'm committed to making this process easier for you. Each week, my expert guest and I unravel a different form of therapeutic intervention in order to bring comfort and understanding and to help you get back to your true self. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Mind Stories. Today, I'm honored to have on as a guest, Jenny Steinberg. Jenny is a licensed marriage and family therapist and licensed professional clinical counselor. She owns a Los Angeles-based psychotherapy practice called Through the Woods Therapy Center, where she oversees a staff of four strength-based, social justice-oriented clinicians and has been a practicing therapist for over a decade. She's been interviewed and featured on The Washington Post, NBC's Today, and Rewire, and currently runs a thriving therapy blog. Her approach to wellness can be summed up as, if you're not harming anyone and you feel good on the inside, you're probably doing okay. Welcome, Jenny. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Mind Stories. Today, I'm excited to have on as our guest, Jenny Steinberg, who is part of Through the Woods Therapy Center in downtown Los Angeles. Welcome, Jenny.
Thanks so much, Josephine. Great to be here.
Yeah, so I'm excited to hear a little bit more about your treatment modality. Can you talk a little bit about your specialty?
Sure. What I do and what everybody at Through the Woods Therapy does is strength-based, social justice-oriented therapy. So strength-based means that we start from the belief that our clients are not broken. Our clients are full of strengths and resiliencies, and that our job is to help people overcome their challenges by identifying and building on their strengths and resiliencies. And the social justice piece, which I think goes hand in hand with the strength-based piece, means that we work with all different kinds of people. We are queer affirming. We come from a feminist orientation with clients of all different genders, and we work with people of a variety of cultures from an informed but humble perspective. And basically, sort of the core of what we do is that if you're not harming anyone and you feel good on the inside, you're probably doing okay. And so the strengths-based piece is really important to that, because what it means is that if somebody comes in and they live a really unusual, non-traditional life, but they feel good about it and they're not hurting anybody, then we don't think that that's a problem. We don't think it's a thing that needs to be diagnosed or changed. We just sort of accept that that is part of the way that they live. So we work with a lot of gender, sexual, and relationship minorities, for example. So we work with people who are polyamorous or who are part of the kink community. And we work with people all across the gender spectrum, people who are transgender as well as people who are non-binary. And also kind of the intersections of all of these different identities with race, with social class, with age, with gender, and the way that all of these things come together to make a human person.
So people probably are drawn to your therapy center because of how they identify who they are themselves, right? And kind of feel like they would be understood in your group because of that.
Exactly. We work with a lot of people who are from marginalized identities of a variety of kinds, but we also work with people who on paper don't seem to have any of these identities, but who are drawn to the idea that, like, maybe they, so the sort of vanilla example that I like to use is, let's say somebody has been told their whole life that they need to be a lawyer because their parent was a lawyer and their parent's parent was a lawyer, or maybe their parents were immigrants and worked really hard in blue collar jobs, and they either were told explicitly or internalized the idea that they had to become a lawyer in order to make their parents' sacrifices worth it. But either way, they're sort of walking through the world with all these shoulds, and they're drawn to the idea that it's okay to be different than other people have told them they're supposed to be.
Got it. Yeah, I could see that would be a common reason why somebody might think about therapy and wanting to talk to somebody.
Yeah, especially with us being based in downtown LA.
Yeah. Well, maybe use that kind of vanilla example that you used in terms of, so say someone identifies themselves as not being kind of who other people have expected them to be, but kind of identifying who they are within themselves. How do you walk through the therapeutic process with that person? What would be the beginning steps?
So at the first session with every client, we provide a little bit of informed consent, but we also talk explicitly about how we work. And we talk about this idea that if you're not harming other people and you feel good on the inside, you're probably doing okay. We also talk about the therapeutic relationship as being kind of a powerful tool and it being okay to be imperfect and to have messy feelings and to bring those feelings into the room. And then in the rest of the first session, we let the client tell us their story. It's mostly client-led and we'll ask some questions or clarify some things. But a lot of clients leave their first session with us going, oh, wow, like I never realized that this way I was feeling was okay. Or I've been given these expectations my whole life and nobody ever like asked me questions that led me to think about what I really want. I was just thinking I was feeling stressed out. Mm-hmm. And so then our second session is the most directive session we do with a client. And that's a goal setting session. And so we ask our clients to imagine their future self. And I sort of will say to a client, I want you to imagine yourself 6 weeks or 6 months or 6 years from now. And you're saying, boy, howdy, I'm so glad I went to therapy. What is that future version of you speaking as that person in the present tense first person? What is that person saying is so different in their life? And so a client will then say, well, you know, I'm really unhappy at my job. And I'll say, wait, hold on. Okay, so I want you to tell me what future you is saying. And they'll say, okay, future me is saying that I look forward to going to work every day when I wake up. So it's really getting them to focus on this version of themselves, which I believe is inside of them already, to kind of reframe this idea of I'm broken, how can I fix this, versus this is what my future could look like if I can navigate the path and figure out what's in my way. It's also about identifying barriers and helping clients remove those barriers.
Right. Yeah. And I'm sure kind of that takes, I mean, going back to kind of thinking about initially, you're talking about if you're not harming other people or yourself, then you're doing okay. I could imagine it takes a little bit of time for someone to get to that point. If the life that they've chosen, you know, other people, maybe family members, the family of origin is saying, you know, it's harming us because you have chosen this life. I'm sure that takes a little bit of time to get to that point to say, that's not harmful to me.
Yeah, exactly. So that's definitely one of the challenges, right? Because people hear this idea, if you're not harming anyone, and they go, well, my mom says that it's really hurting her that I am, that I'm trans and I want to transition, or that I am not interested in pursuing this career that I was always expected to pursue, whatever. This person in my life is telling me that that is hurting them. So how do I reconcile that? Because maybe that means I'm not okay because I'm hurting these other people. So we have to draw a distinction between you have an identity that is authentic to who you are, and that identity is not hurting somebody else. Somebody else is having a difficult time processing it and integrating it, but that's different than hurting somebody else. And so maybe they are feeling hurt, but that doesn't mean you are hurting them.
I like that distinction. That's really helpful.
Yeah.
Okay. So kind of moving on through the therapy. So you're talking about the second session. What are the next steps?
Sure. So the second session, we set goals and we talk through this from this future version of yourself perspective. And then I will say to a client, okay, I'm going to take about 90 seconds and I'm going to take everything that I've written down because I take notes. I don't usually take notes in session, but I do take notes at that session. I'm going to take everything that I've written down and I'm going to try to find some themes and I'm going to synthesize this into like 3 to 5 clinical goals. And then when I finish this, we're going to go over these goals together. And the client says, okay. And they look out the window or just stare awkwardly at me for 90 seconds while I stare at my piece of paper and try to find themes. And so maybe somebody has said future me would not have to deal with my mom telling me that I need to lose weight. Future me would find happier relationships. Future me would find a better work-life balance. And so I look at these different things that sound like they're completely separate. And I say, oh, there's a theme here, and that theme is boundaries. So I'll write a goal that says something like increase assertiveness and set boundaries in order to find greater happiness in family relationships and work. And so when I finish writing this list of goals, I'll say to the client, okay, so I'm going to read you the list of goals that I've created for you. And I want you to tell me if anything doesn't resonate with you, because my goal is for you to leave this session with a list of what future you could achieve that really resonates with what you want. Because strength-based therapy is very focused on the client's goals, not on what I think the client needs to change. And so I'll read the list to the client and I'll say, even if I said A and you think it should be the, like, let me know. I want these to be perfectly worded goals that fit exactly what you want to get out of therapy. And so we'll go over the list. And then once we've refined it to some goals, I'll say, okay, great. Now I want you to imagine, I often use an empty chair for this. I say, put your future self in this empty chair. So I'll say, I want you to think, if I asked you, and I won't do this, but if I asked you to stand up and walk to this empty chair and sit down, you could absolutely do that, right? And the client says, yeah, sure. And I say, okay, well, if I put a giant pile of boulders in between where you're sitting right now on the couch and this empty chair over here, and I asked you to walk over to the chair and sit in it, that would be a lot harder. And the client says, well, yeah, that's true. And okay, so that's what I think therapy is about, because I think that this future version of you is actually already inside you. And there's stuff that's in the way of you getting there. And sometimes I'll give examples. I'll say, for example, you told me at our last session that you were able to ask for your needs to be met this one time. So you're able to set boundaries. It's just a matter of finding the ability to do that all the time and something standing in your way. So what are the things that are standing in your way? What are the boulders that are between you and this empty chair? What are the barriers? And so then we work to figure out what's standing in the way, what's blocking them from getting to the place they want to be. So from day one, we're establishing you are full of strengths, but something's in your way. And we've got to figure out what that is. And maybe it's a value or a message that you've gotten from society or from your life experience. Maybe it's a coping skill that you developed that really served you well to deal with something challenging in your past, but now that challenging thing is no longer part of your life and you're still using this coping skill and it's not serving you anymore. And maybe it's just sort of like fear. Fear is a really common one. People often say the thing that's in my way is myself. And it's like, okay, but what about yourself? Because I'm not going to sit here and like agree with you that you are broken. So let's get more specific. And often what it comes down to is fear. It's like change is really scary and difficult. And it's easier to be uncomfortable, but in familiar territory than it is to venture out of that familiar territory and feel the discomfort of the unknown.
Yeah. I really like that because it empowers the client from the very beginning.
Yeah.
That it's not a deficiency that they have. It's just that these barriers are kind of things that are keeping them from being their true self. Right.
Right.
And it really kind of makes someone understand what, by setting their goals for themselves, working with you to try to figure those out, it's a roadmap in terms of what they're expecting to achieve in therapy and what the process should be.
Yeah, and that's exactly the objective, is to put them in the driver's seat and give them the opportunity to tell me what they want, and also to identify what's in their own way. And I'll help sometimes. I'll even suggest goals sometimes. So let's say in the first session, somebody talks a lot about drinking. And then in the second session, when we're doing goal setting, drinking doesn't come up. I might say to them, you know, this wasn't something that we talked about in the first session, but I'm wondering if you have any concerns around the amount or the frequency of your drinking, because you mentioned that a lot last week, which is why I kind of let them spitball at the first session and just tell their story freeform, because I don't want to just go straight into defining goals without knowing them a little bit. And they might say, oh, you know what? That's right. Actually, I wake up with a hangover every Saturday and Sunday morning, and I really hate it. It interferes with my life. I want to change it. Or yeah, you're right. Because like, I'm here to talk mostly about anger, but I realize that I get angry faster when I'm drunk. Or they might say, you know what? That's actually not something that I really want to look at right now. I want to work on my anger and my anxiety, but not these other things. But not the alcohol. I'm not too concerned about that. And if that's what they say, I sort of tuck it away in my brain that this is a thing that we might circle back to later because it's an important piece of information. But I don't put it on their goals list because they're there to define their goals. And that way I can also, if we're later talking about their anger, I might say, you know, 2-3 months down the line, you know, I've known you for a little while now and you're talking a lot about how you got into all these arguments. It sounds like you were drunk during a lot of them. I know that you said one of your goals wasn't reducing drinking, but can you tell me about that? But always honoring and respecting the goals that they want to work on.
Right. And I could see how that could be particularly helpful for individuals who've been told their whole life that, you know, the way they're thinking is wrong or have a lot of shame around their kind of identity and how they identify themselves. And it's refreshing to be able to say, you know, what's important to you, and let's have you steer this process based on what you need for yourself, right? Instead of being told what they should do. So I can understand why for that type of population, it actually would be so helpful.
Yeah. And we do a ton of shame work, actually. I think every clinician on my staff has read some Brené Brown. They've at least all seen her TED Talk. And I'm certified, or was certified, in the Daring Way, which is her training program for therapists. And shame is such a huge factor because it's a thing that's imposed on so many of us as a way to sort of keep us in line and keep us from being too different. Guilt is a really useful emotion sometimes because it tells you when you're doing something wrong, or it can encourage you to do things that are more pro-social or that are helpful to people who maybe don't share your privilege. But shame is not a particularly useful emotion for us to carry around. It's an emotion that causes a lot of problems, and that's usually externally enforced and comes from external sources.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how this might vary from other more traditional forms of therapy?
Sure.
And what the differences or similarities are?
Yeah. I mean, more traditionally, I think people tend to, I think this is less true in some circles, but I think the traditional model is start with a diagnosis, right? That's certainly the medical model. And it's certainly kind of what we were all taught in grad school about, and it's necessary for insurance billing, right? Is you, at the first session, your goal is to find a label that you can put in your health record system so that you can bill the insurance and they will pay you to treat a diagnosis. But a lot of the people we work with are kind of the worried well. They're not people who meet high clinical criteria. We work with a lot of people who we end up diagnosing with adjustment disorders. And I think that diagnoses can be really helpful and very useful for people who they fit, but not everybody fits neatly into a box. And so more traditional therapy that starts with the diagnosis, which it tends to be a little bit more deficit-based because it involves sort of scrambling to find symptoms that define somebody as being unwell in a certain way so that you can treat a label. But we're not looking to treat a label in strength-based therapy. We're looking to figure out what the function is of the behaviors or the symptoms that a person's experiencing and validate where that's coming from and then provide support in order to help people get better from there, feel better from there.
Right. Okay. Do people maybe come to you who've done other types of therapies and haven't found that they've been that helpful and are drawn to you in this type of strength-based therapy? Does that usually happen? Or I know there's many different kinds of cases.
Yeah, it happens frequently. We hear, you know, I don't know any therapist who doesn't have, or any good therapist who doesn't have people come to them sometimes and say, gosh, you know, I've been to three other therapists, but you're the first one who's really managed to help me. And something that's sort of a valuable and unintended, but sort of intended side effect of strength-based therapy is that we like our clients because we're not looking for problems. We're not looking for ways that they're wrong. We're looking for ways that they're right. And we're looking for nuggets of understanding. And so we tend to really like almost all of our clients because we're coming from this place of, well, what's causing you to do this thing? And when they did a meta study of all these different approaches to therapy, maybe 2 decades ago, what they found is that the thing that causes the most healing for clients in terms of what happens in the therapy room, it's not about the techniques you use or the modality that you use or your toolbox. It's about the relationship between the therapist and the client. And so because we tend to form these really good relationships with our clients because we're looking for strengths and because we're looking for a point of understanding and empathy, I think our clients tend to have a different experience with us than people who come from a more sort of deficit-oriented, although I don't know that any therapist would call themselves deficit-oriented, but, you know, a more traditional kind of start with diagnosis perspective.
Right. Is there anybody that this might not be a good fit for?
Let me think for a second.
I know that's always the hard question.
No. I mean, I'm sure the answer to that is yes. I'm just trying to think of who that population might be.
I was thinking, can I just add something? Yeah. Maybe somebody who is not sure about their identity, maybe, or ambivalent about who they want to be or how they want to be.
We work with a lot of people who are on identity journeys.
Okay.
And so it's not necessarily just like, you are sure that this is your identity, and so we're going to support that. It's also like not knowing is fine. Being wishy-washy is fine. Identity is actually a really fluid thing. We worked with a number of clients who came and identify in one way, and then in the year or two or three that we work with the client, they might identify a different way and then sort of find their way to a third identity, which is like not even necessarily like their true identity or their permanent identity, but where they are now. So no, I think that it works well for folks like that. I'm thinking more in terms of people who like are kind of narcissistic, who don't have the ability to sort of see how they affect other people. It might not be a great fit for people like that because these people are already coming from this perspective of I'm so great and I don't need to change anything. And it might be kind of actually reinforcing of that, of the way that that's harmful to other people, because somebody who has this myopic view where they can do no wrong, which I think is actually deeply rooted in shame, but it's sometimes so deeply rooted that it's hard to get at the core of it. But I think somebody like that might have difficulty looking at different perspectives in order to make changes in a way that they can be less harmful to other people.
That makes sense. Could we go back to the fluidity of identity a little bit? So I think it would be helpful to the listener, and I'm also really interested to talk about this, how, you know, people think about identity as fixed most of the time, right? But
yeah.
I would love for you to talk a little bit more about the fluidity. And it sounds like it's almost as if your identity is who you are in that current moment.
Sure. An easy example is 6 months ago, I became a parent. And so my focus changed pretty dramatically when I became a parent. And that became kind of my core identity, whereas my core identity prior to that was that I was a therapist and a business owner. And those are still things that are true about me, but it's not where the bulk of my focus is. But this happens all the time with sexual orientation and gender identity as well. So, for example, a sort of textbook trans narrative is I was assigned male at birth, but I've always known I'm female. When I was a child, I put on my mom's high heels and dress, and people yelled at me and said, no, you're not supposed to do that. You're a boy. And so I hid this part of myself for years and years, and now I'm finally going to be authentic and come out and present myself to the world as who I really, truly, genuinely have always been. But in over a decade of serving transgender and non-binary clients, I've heard every variation of that story. Some people who say, well, you know, I really thought that I was male for the first 3 decades of my life. And I started cross-dressing in my 20s, but didn't really think that that was an indication of what my gender identity was. And then when I got to my mid-30s, I realized more and more that actually, like, she is a more resonant pronoun for me. And so I decided to start transitioning. So the way that people perceive their, and it's not that this person was lying to themselves for 30 years. It's that this person was genuinely identifying in one way. Or I know somebody in my personal life who identified as a straight woman for the first 30 years of, I don't know why it's always 30, but and it's not always 30. That just happens to be the two people I'm thinking of, who identified as a straight woman for 30 years and then met her wife and doesn't now identify as bisexual. She identifies as a lesbian, and she's no longer attracted to men at all. So people go through these very interesting identity journeys, and a lot of the time people will call whatever's in the middle a phase, but it's not necessarily a phase, because when somebody's in that moment, when that's how they're identifying, it's genuinely how they're identifying. And just because they end up somewhere else doesn't make it less legitimate or valid.
Right. And I'm sure part of the process is also kind of talking about a history of how you've identified yourself, but also understanding what factors were at play that led into that identification.
Totally. Yeah, you're right. Maybe you meet someone, or maybe you experience something that kind of tectonically shifts your life, which causes you to think about the way that you conceptualize yourself. Maybe you were following a script and never realized you were following a script. or maybe somebody suggested a label and it was the closest you'd ever come to finding something that sounded like it resonated with you, but then you hear another label or get to know somebody who identifies a different way and you think to yourself, well, actually that maybe is closer to what my experience is or what my experience is at this time.
Right. Well, I was also thinking about kind of being told how you should be. And so if you're told that, maybe you take on that identity because you feel like that's what you need to be, how you need to be.
Sure.
And you identify with that for a period of time before maybe you're able to kind of take a step back and kind of understand yourself a little bit better too.
Sure. A story we've heard frequently is like, when I was 5 years old, people started saying to me, wow, you are so opinionated, you're going to be a lawyer. And so I became a lawyer. And if I'm not a lawyer, I don't know who the heck I am.
Right. Yeah.
And that's very scary too, to kind of like shift from this identity that's been defined for you, because what you're left with when you get rid of that is literally every other possibility in the entire world.
So how long does this, it's not a time-limited therapy, strength-based therapy, is it?
That's right. No, it's not.
So it's open-ended in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, it is open-ended. But the goals kind of keep us grounded. And if somebody seems to be running out of things to say or seems to be feeling a lot better or comes into sessions a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks in a row and seems to be doing what I call grocery listing, hey, I went to the store this week and I got milk and I got eggs and I got bread, then I will say to that person, hey, you know, I really enjoy meeting with you, but I'm wondering what we're working on right now because it seems like you don't have a whole lot to talk about. Would you like to look at your goals? So typically we make this goal list in the second session and then we don't look at it again for a year unless somebody is coming up on sort of one of these points of kind of seeming like they don't have a whole lot of content that they're bringing in. And so either when we hit one of these kind of snags or when we hit a year, we pull out the goal list and we say, okay, let's go through these goals one at a time and see if these goals are, if we've made any progress on them, if they still resonate, and if there's anything new that's come up that's missing. And so let's say it's been 6 months and a client comes in and they're grocery listing. So we pull out the goals and the client might say, you know what? I really feel like my anxiety is more under wraps. I feel like I'm setting better boundaries. So I've done, let's say, goals 1, 2, and 3. But goal number 4, processing the loss of my dad 10 years ago. Like, we really haven't talked about that. And I maybe have even sort of been avoiding that because that's a really hard thing. But maybe I've been talking about things that aren't that meaningful the last couple of weeks because I don't want to talk about that. And I've sort of resolved everything else. And then we have a conversation. Okay, you don't want to talk about it. Do you feel like it's something you need to talk about? Or sometimes we go through the goals and it's like, check, check, check. Okay, great. Are you ready to graduate from therapy? Or is there something else that we need to be working on? And often the conversation is, well, great. Let's, depending on when this comes up in the session, let's do a termination session or let's make next week our last session and we'll kind of reflect on your progress and dedicate that session to kind of figuring out how to move forward. And also like what red flags would be if some of these things were to start to come back in your life and you needed more support.
Yeah. And I can imagine, right, that it's kind of a therapy that is, the door is open. And so just because you reached your goals during the first kind of go around and maybe you feel like you've reached them, you might kind of take a little bit of time off therapy, but ultimately you might have different goals that you redefine over time that might bring you back into the same process.
Yeah, we definitely have clients come back 6 months, a year or more later and say, oh, so I was doing great. And then this thing came up and now I'm really struggling. Or this new thing happened in my life and I could use some help kind of dealing with that. Sometimes when a client comes back for a sort of second round of therapy, so to speak, it's pretty quick because what it consists of is I have this new thing that's happening in my life and I need some help with it. And the response to that is, well, okay, so this reminds me a little bit of that old thing that happened in your life that we dealt with it. And so we meet for a handful of sessions and realize that the same skills that got them through the other thing can get them through this new thing. Not always, but that's not an infrequent occurrence.
Right. This was so helpful for me to learn more about the work you do. I've worked with you with many clients and, you know, I didn't really know exactly the ins and outs of strength-based therapy. I mean, not that I'm an expert at it just by listening, but I think I really have a better grasp of what it is. And I like to hear about it because it feels so hopeful too and so proactive, right?
Yeah, I'm really glad to hear that.
Yeah. And I think it's a type of therapy that the general public maybe doesn't know exactly you don't hear it that often, and so they don't really know what it is, but it just makes so much sense to me. If the listener is interested in just learning more about it, what would be a good resource? Just if they could check out something online or a book, or I mean, what are some good resources for people?
So strength-based therapy is kind of a school of thought that is probably more traditionally referenced in therapy circles as postmodern therapy, which is a collection of therapies like narrative. But strength-based is more, there's the more foundational idea that clients come to therapy to uncover and build on their strengths. I first encountered strength-based therapy at the first workshop I ever went to while I was still in grad school, which was led by somebody named Barry Duncan, who works with Scott Miller, who perhaps is a little bit better known. And the two of them do really strength-based work. And their work is also, and we don't do this so much, but their work is also very feedback informed, where they will give surveys to clients at the beginning and end of every session in order to gather data about progress and kind of track how that's going. And also regularly at every single session, a survey that checks in on the therapeutic relationship. If I were a client, I'd get really annoyed by those surveys, so we don't use those. But the presentation from Barry Duncan that I saw was just transformative in how I thought of this work. And his book, The Heroic Client, Barry Duncan also wrote What's Right With You. So I think The Heroic Client is geared more towards therapists, and What's Right With You is more targeted at clients. And it's this idea that you start from a place of accepting yourself. Also, anything by Brené Brown, which talks about especially her first three mainstream books, The Gifts of Imperfection, Daring Greatly, and Rising Strong. And those are kind of a really nice trilogy because they talk about it's okay not to be perfect. Here's what shame is. Here's how you get up when you've been knocked on the floor. And it's a very who you are is okay approach. So all of her stuff. And also, if people don't want to read a whole book, she has a TED Talk that went viral about imperfection and vulnerability. I think it's called The Power of Vulnerability. And that's also an extremely good and concise resource. I think it's like a 15-minute TED Talk.
We'll add those links too.
Great, cool.
And we'll also include your website so people can learn a little bit more about you and the work that you do at Through with the Woods Therapy. It's a great resource to have in downtown Los Angeles.
Awesome. Thank you.
Before we finish up, is there anything that you want to tell the listener that we didn't get to?
Yes. So Through the Woods Therapy Center, which I started about 3 years ago, was founded based on my desire to provide strength-based and social justice-informed therapy to a wider variety of clients than I myself can just serve. And it is grounded in these principles, but each therapist also brings their own therapeutic orientation and background to the practice and to the work that they do. Some people bring a little bit of CBT, and some people bring a little bit of narrative therapy, and some people bring a little bit of psychodynamic therapy. So I think that this strength-based modality can be really complementary with other approaches to therapy, because every therapist in the practice has the same values and approaches that I do, but they also sort of have their own flavor based on the way that they were trained. So I think that those go really well together. But what I really wanted was, after grad school, I moved to Boston for a few years. And there's this place in South Boston in Jamaica Plain called The Meeting Point, which was a collection of independently practicing psychotherapists and body workers who were queer affirming, who were culturally affirming, and who were disability affirming. And I loved that existed. And that just felt like such a great place to practice. And I had sort of started to fantasize about like buying a big house and converting it to a therapy office, which is maybe a little bit more realistic in Jamaica Plain than in downtown Los Angeles. But Through the Woods is kind of grounded in similar ideas, which is that like I wanted to create a safe community for people who fall outside the norm to find supportive treatment.
Yeah. And it seems like such a wonderful resource for people to know that you're there. And I think you have a lot of information on your website to kind of draw people in to understand kind of what your mission is and who you want to treat and to welcome everybody where they're at, right? From kind of such an accepting perspective, which I think is really refreshing and what people want when they're looking for therapy.
Yeah.
I really appreciate your time and educating us all about strength-based therapy. We'll be in touch, and I really appreciate you taking your time out of your day to talk with us.
Thanks, Josephine. I appreciate you interviewing me. It was fun.
All right. Take care.
All right. You too.
This has been Mind Stories. With remote appointments in California and offices in downtown Los Angeles, Santa Monica, Hermosa Beach, Marina Del Rey, and Echo Park, Cal Psychiatry specializes in medication management, mood and anxiety disorders, alternative therapies, women's mental health, and more to help you get back to your true self. Visit us at calpsychiatry.com. Thank you for listening to Mind Stories, and don't forget to subscribe.